Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portions throughout today's conference. During the question-and-answer portions, if you would like to ask a question on the phone, you may use star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Craig Haug. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and welcome everybody to the NGS J6JK Open Meeting. Next slide, please. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded and transcribed. Next slide. And a welcome from all the NGS CMDs, including Drs. Avadele, Boren, Cunningham, Darden, Haug, and McKinney. Next slide, please. The proposed policies, LCDs, on the agenda for today include thyroid nodule molecular testing, respiratory pathogen panel testing, epidural procedures for pain management, non-invasive fractional flow reserve FFR for stable ischemic heart disease, and CT tomography, CCT, and coronary computed tomography angiography, CCTA. Next slide, please. The first draft under discussion is one of mine, and thyroid nodule molecular testing. This draft was prompted by an LCD request, and over 600,000 thyroid fine needle aspiration biopsies are performed every year in the United States, with approximately 20% classified as indeterminate. In other words, cannot absolutely determine whether it's benign or cancerous. Previously, most went on to diagnostic thyroid surgery, usually lobectomy, with most, 75 to 95%, ultimately confirmed to be benign. So the vast majority of those indeterminate ultimately were benign and arguably didn't require that surgery. Molecular marker testing is a potential method to augment risk stratification of indeterminate cases, those cases we just discussed, ideally reducing the need for diagnostic thyroid surgery or completion thyroidectomy with their attendant risks and costs. The LCD coverage criteria in this draft are on the slide, and to summarize, describes those patient characteristics most likely to benefit from molecular testing, namely indeterminate cytology, in a patient without other indications for surgery, and who would be willing to potentially undertake surveillance should the molecular test results indicate low cancer risk. Next slide. In summary, these coverage criteria support guideline-based molecular testing of thyroid nodules, but also look forward to future studies that better define clinical utility, especially given recent improvements in imaging and cytologic classification. We received three requests to comment on this policy. The first up is Dr. Desai. Operator, can you see if Dr. Desai is available and open his line, if so?
Yes, I'm here.
Excuse me?
Yes, Dr. Desai, your line is open.
This is Dr. Desai. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Dr. Desai. Please proceed.
Thank you. So my name is Dimpi Desai. I recently completed my endocrinology fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania a year ago, where I trained with Dr. Susan Mendel, one of the world experts on thyroid nodules. And since a year, I've been working as assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine, and one of my clinical areas is thyroid nodules and thyroid cancer, and I have no conflicts of interest for today. Next slide. So as thyroid clinicians, we're very excited to see that molecular testing for thyroid nodules is now considered medically necessary. As Dr. Hawk correctly pointed, that about 20 to 40% of the times we encounter this very common diagnosis of indeterminate cytology of Bethesda 3 and Bethesda 4, where the cytology is just not clear enough to tell us benign versus malignant. And where formerly these patients would go for surgery, now we have the option of molecular testing for them. And the topic for today is to discuss the requirement of two FNAs for Bethesda 3 cytology before a molecular test can be done. And for that, to discuss further, I would like to talk about my study, which I did during my fellowship a year ago that was published at Cancer Cytopathology last year. Next slide. So for this study, our objective was to study the performance of Thyroseq version 3, so Bethesda 3 and Bethesda 4 nodules only. At Penn, we started using this study in December 2017, right when it came out. And for this study, I looked at data from December 2017 to August 2019, and to evaluate all the nodules that underwent Thyroseq testing at our institute. Total, we had about 415 cases that underwent Thyroseq testing, out of which 251 were of the class of Bethesda 3, and 164 were of Bethesda 4 cytology. And we had surgery and pathology results available for a total of 127 nodules. And our primary objective was to study how accurate is this test, or to determine its performance in predicting the diagnosis of which of these nodules are benign versus which of these nodules are malignant. So we just wanted to know how good this study is by comparing the Thyroseq results to the final pathology results. Next slide. So the first table here gives us the performance of Thyroseq version 3, and I'll focus on Bethesda 3 nodules. The sensitivity of this test was 95%, specificity 94%, negative predictive value 99.5%, and positive predictive value 61%. I would like to focus on the negative predictive value of 99.5% for Bethesda 3 nodules, which means that if a nodule with Bethesda 3 cytology resulted negative on the Thyroseq version 3 test, there's a 99.5% chance that this is benign, and hence that would reduce so many unnecessary diagnostic lobectomies or diagnostic surgeries that the patient would have otherwise gone for. The next question is, how often are we seeing this negative result for Bethesda 3? And for that, we calculated the benign call rate, and out of the 251 nodules with Bethesda 3 cytology, 206 were negative by Thyroseq, which means that for 82% of these nodules which have Bethesda 3 cytology, the result comes as Thyroseq negative, and then 99.5% of these then eventually are benign on surgery, which means that the high benign call rate of these tests for Bethesda 3 will help us to eliminate a lot of unnecessary surgeries that otherwise the patients would go for. Secondly, out of these 206 Bethesda 3 nodules, 13 still underwent surgery, either for patient preference or anxiety or compression symptoms. And initially, one was cancer, but we reviewed the pathology and then it came as benign. That means all the Bethesda 3 with negative Thyroseq that underwent surgery had a benign pathology. So we concluded that the high benign call rate of this Thyroseq test for Bethesda 3 nodule will prevent a lot of unnecessary surgeries in about 82% of patients. When a patient has a negative result on this test, the clinician as well as the patient will be relieved that this nodule is benign, and hence no further follow-up will be needed in terms of FNA or surgery. This will improve the patient quality of life as well as the need for any further intervention. If the requirement is there for two FNAs, then that would add additional anxiety for the patient to wait another 3 months and then to have another FNA, which may be followed by a molecular test, which leads to more anxiety, more cost, and then some patients may just go for diagnostic lobectomies, which would actually increase the healthcare cost. And for those reasons, I think that a negative Thyroseq test after the first FNA for Bethesda 3 would really help in reducing the overall healthcare cost for thyroid nodules and Bethesda 3 cytology. Thank you, and with this, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We would now like to open the phone lines for any questions on the audio side. If you would like to ask a question, please unmute your phone.
Yeah, this is Dr. Haug. I'll start in. Dr. Desai, thank you for these comments and also for sending me a copy of your paper. I do have a question on the data that you just showed, though, and whether it's somewhat the numbers are a little bit more inflated than maybe they should be. The data includes 263 thyrosec negative patients who did not undergo surgery and therefore for whom there was no definitive histologic data.
Yeah.
In your paper, you say that the data on all these 263 assumes, in terms of for the purposes of calculation, that they were all true negatives.
Yes.
In other words, no false negatives. However, there were 31 thyrosec negative patients that chose surgery, even though they were thyrosec negative, for various reasons.
Right.
And among these, five turned out to be malignant, which is a 16% false negative rate, far different from that 0% that's assumed for those 263. And even in your paper, you have another chart or table similar to this that just looks at those 127 patients for whom histologic follow-up was available. In other words, you have a one-to-one match between the thyrosec results and actual histologic data from the surgical specimen. And in that chart, in that table, the specificity drops from the 90% on the all nodules here, shown in your slide, to 46%, big difference, and the negative positive value drops from 98% to 84%. I wonder if you could comment on this.
Yeah, so to answer your first question, for the five false negative cases, four of them were Bethesda 4. And, you know, we know that Bethesda 4 has a higher rate of malignancy than Bethesda 3. So four were Bethesda 4 and also all low risk as defined by ATA. One of them was Bethesda 3, and then that's the one that we re-reviewed the pathology, and there was no capsular invasion. So actually, it was a follicular adenoma, not a follicular carcinoma. So later in my paper, I have discussed that, you know, initially we presented the result that, yes, there were five false negatives because this is real-world data. But then when we re-evaluated those five false negatives, the one with Bethesda 3 is actually a follicular adenoma, which means that none of the Bethesda 3 classes had any false negative cases at the end. And to answer your second question, where we did, you know, we do, this is in even all other studies, either Tyroseq or any other molecular testing, often consider negative cases as true negatives for their practical application, and real-world scenario is the same, and that's what we did as well. But when we looked at the data for just the 127 nodules for histological follow-up, if you just focus on the Bethesda 3 performance, then the sensitivity is the same as 95%, and the specificity does drop, but the main point is the negative predictive value still stays high at 92%, and the main reason of these molecular testing is to correctly identify the benign nodules so that the unnecessary surgeries are avoided. So even with the histologic follow-up for 127 nodules, the negative predictive value stayed 92%.
Right, which is still lower than the 99.5 in the data that you're showing. And like I said, the specificity did drop from 94%, just sticking to the Bethesda 3, to 48%. I mean, that's, I guess my basic question is it really fair to show data that assumes incorrectly that all those that you don't have histologic information on were true negatives when you know that that can't be
true? Right, right. But for practical, you know, for practical reasons, for all those negatives will be considered true negatives, then I think long-term follow-up is lacking, and definitely more studies would be needed for long-term follow-up. But even if they do have malignancy in the future or they are false negative, they would be low risk by ETA.
Great. Thank you. And again, thank you for your comments and thank you for sending the paper so I could look at it ahead of time congratulations on finishing your training and getting a study published on top of it. So,
thank you. Thank you.
Okay. The next speaker on the agenda is Dr. Hodak. Operator, can you see if Dr. Hodak, can you open his line if he's available?
Dr. Hodak, your line is open.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to speak to the group today. I'm Stephen Hodak. I'm a professor of medicine and endocrinology at NYU Langone Health. My practice is basically entirely related to thyroid nodules, thyroid cancer, and thyroid disease. I'm also intimately familiar with molecular diagnostic testing. Since in the early 2000s, when I was at University of Pittsburgh, tests like ThyroSeq were just being developed, and I had the opportunity to participate in much of the clinical validation of the early tests and the processes that led to what we now have available commercially in the market. I will disclose that I've received compensation for speaking for Sonic Healthcare USA on behalf of ThyroSeq. I will also disclose that prior to receiving that compensation, I very happily spoke on behalf of ThyroSeq because I think it's an excellent test that I find extremely helpful and useful for clinical care of my many thyroid patients. Next slide, please. There is some literature, it's limited, but there is some literature that looks at this issue of outcomes when indeterminate cytology results are repeated, and I think the question at hand really is, can a discordant result, a second biopsy result that is, for instance, benign, reverse or negate an initial biopsy result that is indeterminate? I actually think that's a bad idea. I think that there's a lot of problem with light microscopic diagnosis and cytology in general, and these categories of benign versus malignant are extremely fungible. There's very nice data that I won't present that shows that when cytology cases are reviewed, opinions about what the actual gold standard diagnosis is are widely discordant, and I think it points to the fact that we are at a hard limit of what is possible with light microscopic diagnosis, and this idea that you can get a different diagnosis from biopsying the same nodule is not a trivial issue. In this data that was presented from Memorial Sloan Kettering of a large population with about 450 patients with indeterminate AUS Bethesda III cytology, what we can see is that if you look at the second biopsy result, there was a cohort of 96 patients. Almost 43% of those patients had a second cytologic diagnosis of benign. In my mind, this represents a problem because that means 43% of the patients that are evaluated are now in this gray zone where it's unclear whether we should believe or discount the original diagnosis of indeterminate and rely instead on the second diagnosis of benign. I think what this would lead to for this large number of patients is more intensive follow-up, additional ultrasonography, more office visits, additional costs that I think would accrue because we're now dealing with uncertainty again rather than a definitive result. And I believe molecular testing is a far better way to make a definitive diagnosis in this case, and that definitive result with molecular testing would allow us to appropriately de-escalate the intensity of follow-up in many cases. And I brought a case to show you that I hope will make that point. Next slide, please. So this is one of my patients, a 56-year-old man with a 4-centimeter thyroid nodule. You can see the nodule on the ultrasound. It is heterogeneous. It's fairly isoechoic. There's an irregular border. There's a large shadowing macrocalcification in the center and perhaps some small microcalcifications within the nodule. It was a solitary nodule. His regional lymph nodes were normal. He had no risk factors for thyroid cancer. Next slide, please. He had a biopsy that was done elsewhere. It was read as Bethesda III atypia of undetermined significance. And the question here is, what would be the next most appropriate step? I think the group is perhaps suggesting that repeat FNA cytology would be the right next step. I would argue that molecular diagnostic testing would be reasonable in this case. Next slide, please. So he did undergo a repeat FNA, and this time it was read as benign. So if the plan would be to not advance the molecular diagnostic testing, we would stop here and then put this patient on a path where continued observation would be done. In this case, I did, however, get the molecular diagnostic result because I was concerned about, A, how the nodule looked, and also the extent of the atypia on the original cytology. And it was indeed positive for an ETV6 NTRK3 fusion. This is a gene fusion that conveys a very high risk of invasive thyroid cancer approaching 100%. And I think that was very useful information. Next slide. He underwent a total thyroidectomy, and he did indeed have an infiltrative, invasive follicular variant papillary thyroid cancer with vascular invasion. There was extrathyroidal extension, multiple positive lymph nodes. He then underwent adjuvant radioactive iodine therapy, and I just want to point out in the SPECT CT that you see below, there's a focus of uptake in the lung. So at initial presentation, this patient also had a lung metastasis. Next slide, please. So how does this happen? So this is a photomicrograph of the actual tumor histology, and what you may be able to appreciate is that it's extremely heterogeneous. In the smaller box more to the right, you can see that the cells in that area look dark and blue. In the larger box to the left, you can see the pink colloid typical of benign thyroid tissue with lots of very bland epithelial cells. Tumors are heterogeneous, and they are histologically they're not the same when you look throughout a tumor in many cases. A biopsy from this area that's more blue from the smaller box on the right is going to produce cytology that looks overtly abnormal. However, a biopsy from the area on the left is going to look far more normal and perhaps even benign. And this is not an infrequent finding when we evaluate thyroid tumors. If, however, we were to look at the molecular diagnostic signature of the epithelial cells in both of these specimens, since we know this is a clonally neoplastic nodule, a tumor that originated from a single progenitor cell that enlarged and divided to form a clone, we know that even the areas that look benign would have the same molecular genetic signature for cancer that the more morphologically overtly normal cells would also show. Next slide. So I'll just conclude by saying that there is no reliable data on the safety of observation in thyroid nodules with benign cytology that follows an initial diagnosis of Bethesda 3 or FLUS-AUS. Repeat FNA for these Bethesda 3 nodules is suggested in some management guidelines, but is certainly not required by any current thyroid nodule guidelines for many of the consensus organizations like American Thyroid Association, the Endocrine Society, American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, et cetera. Repeat FNA is not required for molecular testing by other Medicare carriers and commercial payers, and I fear that if this becomes a requirement, it would complicate and delay patient access to needed care and molecular testing. It would limit the use of molecular testing and require further hardship for the patients who will have to return for second procedures in the office, take more time off work, it'll increase anxiety and waiting. And I think all of that is relatively unnecessary because I think molecular testing represents a really excellent way of resolving these indeterminate cases. I'll stop there and I'm happy to take questions.
Dr. Hodak, I have a question for you. You mentioned specifically that this is in the need for a second FNA in Bethesda 3 isn't required by any current thyroid nodule guidelines. And I think you actually specifically cited the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons. Is that correct?
I didn't, but I know
okay.
That they've made I'm not actually sure what theirs are.
Okay, because it's the 2020 American Association of Endocrine Surgeons guidelines does recommend it. I'll just quote the sentence. They say, for results in Bethesda 3 category, nodules may undergo repeat FNAB, which leads to more definitive reclassification of 60 to 65%, and thus is recommended as the next clinical management step. So I guess from my perspective, this is somewhat at odds with your claim, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, you know, my thoughts are if we followed that reasoning, this patient that I just presented with a metastatic cancer would have been dismissed as a benign biopsy as a more definitive result. I think just logically, I don't
know. No, but I understand that, but just sticking to your claim about the guidelines, I think that there are some guidelines out there that do recommend it. Would you agree with that?
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're stating that, I mean, I'll take your word for it. I'm not familiar with their specific guideline. I know that many of these guidelines are also based on consensus and opinion, and they're not, you know, soundly based on fact or evidence. And the fact is, I would just wonder how it is that a second biopsy result of benign is more definitive and more correct than an initial diagnosis that shows atypia. Does it mean the first diagnosis is incorrect or wrong?
Yeah, I understand that reasonable people can argue and debate that point. I was just focusing on whether there are guidelines, and I assume that the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons in 2020 is very recent, is an important guideline, but maybe I'm incorrect about that. Is that incorrect?
No, I don't think you're incorrect, but guidelines are guidelines. They're often based on...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, establish whether there were no guidelines or at least there were some. I just did note that the NCCN, which had until their most recent guideline, did basically say repeat FNA for Bethesda 3, and they just changed it to consider repeat FNA. So even the NCCN, until the very latest, version 1, 2021, seem to recommend a second FNA for Bethesda 3 also. So anyway, that's all I had. I just wanted to ask and flesh out the question. I understand there's arguments to be made for and against guidelines in general, but I just wanted to establish that there are some guidelines that do recommend it. Dr. Hodak, thank you for your comments. I appreciate you being here today. We can move on to the next speaker, I think. Next is Dr. Levine. Operator, can you see if Dr. Levine is available?
Dr. Levine, your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak at this meeting. My name is Dr. Robert Levine, and I'm a board-certified endocrinologist, and I'm the medical director at the Thyroid Center of New Hampshire. I've been practicing endocrinology for over 30 years, and my practice has been limited to disorders of the thyroid for over 20 years. I was the director of the Thyroid Ultrasound and Biopsy course for the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology between 2005 and 2015, and I've been an instructor in thyroid ultrasound and biopsy for the American Thyroid Association, the Endocrine Society, and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology for more than 15 years. I've been an author and editor of three textbooks of thyroid ultrasound and thyroid biopsy, and I've written several additional chapters on thyroid biopsy technique. I have no conflicts of interest, and I have no outside support. I'd like to discuss the medical decision-making for thyroid nodules, specifically how a Bethesda 3 biopsy is interpreted in relation to other information, explaining why a policy of necessitating a repeat biopsy for Bethesda 3 cytology is clearly not in the best interest of the patient. When evaluating a patient with a thyroid nodule, the medical decision-making involves sequential steps. Approximately 1 or 2% of thyroid nodules harbor a malignancy, but all nodules are not equal. For example, patients with a strong family history of thyroid cancer or history of exposure to radiation start with a higher risk of having cancer. All patients with a nodule should have an ultrasound, and ultrasonographic findings can be either reassuring or concerning. Both the American Thyroid Association and the American College of Radiology have developed systems which assign a probability of malignancy based on the ultrasonographic features and make a determination of whether a biopsy is necessary based on that risk and the size of the nodule. Following the biopsy, the pretest probability of malignancy based on the ultrasound is revised, and the medical decision-making progresses to whether observation or surgery is most appropriate. As we've heard, approximately 15 to 20% of the time, the initial biopsy is indeterminate, including both B3 and B4 lesions. In the past, most of these patients underwent diagnostic surgery, but as we've heard from the prior speakers, the use of molecular markers has been shown to drastically decrease the need for diagnostic surgery. The proposal we're discussing today would necessitate a repeat biopsy in all Bethesda III lesions prior to performing molecular markers. Clearly, the only advantage of this approach is potential cost savings. When analyzing the cost savings, however, it's important to consider the cost of repeat biopsy and cytology in all those cases, as well as the cost of molecular markers in approximately 40% of cases. When you add in the 5% of repeat biopsies that will be insufficient from that same paper out of Memorial, the cost savings are going to be quite small. However, there are multiple disadvantages to this approach. From a patient viewpoint, the most important is being faced with the need for a repeat biopsy in as many as 15 to 20% of all cases. To a patient, there's a huge difference between having four needles stuck into their neck and having eight needles into their neck in two sessions. Equally important is a three-month delay in diagnosis. Guidelines recommend that a repeat biopsy not be performed immediately, as there will be regeneration artifact, which will increase the false positive rate of the repeat biopsy. Recommendations for delay range from 1 to 3 months, and in my practice, I wait a full 3 months, as I have had multiple cases where the repeat results were misleading after waiting a shorter time frame. That three-month delay in diagnosis gives the patient a three-month window of high anxiety regarding both the diagnosis and the upcoming procedure. In addition, there is the possibility of disease progression if the nodule does harbor an aggressive cancer. The need for repeat biopsy results in cost as well as inconvenience and lost time for both the patient and the provider. Perhaps the most important disadvantage to the patient of the proposed approach is the lack of predictive value that is obtained from the molecular markers. The markers not only give a probability of whether malignancy is present, but also whether the lesion is likely to be a low-grade, intermediate, or high-grade cancer. This information is extremely important in determining the extent of surgery, not just the need for surgery. In a patient with an initial Bethesda III lesion, as Steve has told us, it's unclear how reassuring a subsequent benign biopsy will be. However, if molecular markers are performed and no mutations are present, one can certainly de-escalate the intensity of future monitoring. When I'm faced with a negative molecular marker profile, I'm comfortable with observation. However, if a patient had an intermediate or high-risk lesion on ultrasound and an initial Bethesda III biopsy with a repeat biopsy of Bethesda II, I am not comfortable following that patient loosely, and I will intensively monitor the patient with serial ultrasounds and likely even repeat a third biopsy. Currently, when I obtain informed consent prior to biopsy, the patient is told that there's approximately a 2% chance that the biopsy will be insufficient and non-diagnostic, and I'll need to repeat the biopsy. Under the proposed regulation, when obtaining informed consent, I will have to tell the patient that there is a 1 in 5 chance that we will end up with a Bethesda III cytology and need to repeat the biopsy procedure. So before I have performed my first biopsy on the patient, I'll be telling them there is a 1 in 5 chance rather than a 1 in 50 chance that we will be going through the entire procedure again in the future. While biopsy is relatively painless in good hands, it may be quite uncomfortable in others. Patient anxiety is extremely high regarding this procedure, and subjecting 20% of them to a repeat biopsy is not in their best interest. So in conclusion, medical decision-making for thyroid nodules integrates clinical parameters, ultrasound findings, cytology, and molecular markers to determine both the need for surgery and the extent of surgery. The presence of a mutation in a Bethesda III nodule provides invaluable information regarding both the need for and, more importantly, the extent of the surgery to be done. Requiring a second biopsy following Bethesda III cytology may save a small cost at the expense of patient inconvenience, risk to the patient, and lack of extremely useful prognostic information to be gained. Performance of molecular markers should be a decision made by the clinician based on the total information available, including clinical factors, ultrasound findings, the actual cytology, and the patient's concerns. And doing a repeat biopsy should be an option in decision in medical decision making rather than a requirement.
Dr. Levine, thank you for those comments. Just one comment and then one question for me. Just to make clear, Medicare coverage doesn't include consideration of cost. I know you mentioned that may be in the mix, we're actually not allowed to include considerations of cost in our coverage determinations. You mentioned that as it stands, all Bethesda 3 lesions require repeat testing. At the end, I think you mentioned that you think it should be an option. Can you describe the patient characteristics that would lead you to a repeat FNA rather than going right to molecular testing?
There are very few situations where I would choose that as an option. However, there may be patients who, because of the cost that they may run into from co-pays and co-insurances, say, I would rather have it performed again. I would certainly try and talk the patient out of it because I don't believe that it's extremely useful, even when it comes back benign the second time. There are also situations, a paper that I wrote some years ago with Dr. John Abley, where we looked at artifacts that result in Bethesda 3 cytology. And there can be a clot artifact and other things that lead to a misread on those. So I look at my own cytology images provided back to me from the pathologist, and if I were looking at it and saying that it were a poor biopsy that resulted in B3, in those situations, I may go on to a repeat biopsy rather than molecular markers.
So aside from cost considerations and a technically inadequate FNA, you're saying, no, you wouldn't do a repeat?
I didn't follow your question.
Well, it seemed like the two situations you described where you might consider a repeat rather than going on some molecular testing would be cost, co-pays, et cetera, you mentioned, and also where there's the original FNA was technically inadequate.
Correct.
Did I have that right? Okay.
Yes.
So aside from that, though, just other characteristics of the initial FNA or ultrasound characteristics or symptom, there's no other clinical criteria that would induce you to do a repeat FNA?
No, there would not be.
Okay. Dr. Levine, thank you for your comments and answering the questions. I find it very informative. Operator, can you see if there are any other comments on this policy?
Thank you. We would like to open the phone lines for any questions. If anyone does have a question, please unmute your phone, hit star 1 and record your name when prompted. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question. One moment to see if we have questions on the phone. And I am currently showing no questions on the phone.
Thank you, operator. So comments on this policy at this open meeting are now closed. Dr. Elwadelli, I believe you're up next.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Haug. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Ola Elwadelli, and I am the lead CMD on this next draft policy, which is respiratory pathogen panel testing. The indications we have on this draft policy is that respiratory pathogen panel testing in outpatient Part B settings will be considered medically reasonable and necessary when all of the following are met. One, the panel is with less than or greater less than or equal to 5 respiratory pathogens are performed, and both of the following criteria are met within the same test. The outpatient setting is equipped to deliver timely results, and for patients where it's demonstrated that clinical management can result in an improved health outcome, so clinical utility is established. The limitations of this policy, and it's more a setting, a place of service limitation, is that the following is considered not medically reasonable and necessary. Panels with greater than 5 respiratory pathogens performed in the Part B outpatient setting. A study that we reviewed for this draft LCD demonstrated that other than testing for influenza and recognition of the importance of identifying COVID-19, testing for multiple pathogens using respiratory pathogen panel tests have not been proven to impact clinical decision-making, resulting in improved patient outcomes. Therefore, we're concluding in this draft policy that respiratory pathogen panel tests for greater than 5 respiratory pathogens are not medically reasonable and necessary for the purposes of Medicare coverage. Again, this not medically reasonable and necessary statement is in the Part B setting. So we did have a request to give a presentation on this draft LCD. Operator, could you see if Dr. Pritt is on the line? And if he is, if we could open up his line.
Yes. One moment here. And Dr. Pritt.
Can you hear me?
Your line is open. Yep, your line is open.
Okay, his or her line. I was just about to say his or her line when I saw the spelling of Bobby, but okay.
Thank you very much. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this today. My name is Dr. Pritt, Bobby Pritt, and I'm the chair of the Division of Clinical Microbiology at Mayo Clinic. I'm a board-certified clinical microbiologist and pathologist, and we do a number of multiplex respiratory panels at my laboratory. We also do more targeted assays, and I am here to say that there's utility, I believe, in multiple different approaches really based on the clinical presentation and optimal test utilization. So if you can go to the next slide, please. So I don't have any conflicts of interest. I will be discussing specifically the BioFire respiratory panel, as that's the panel that we use in my laboratory, but I don't have any financial interest or conflicts with that product. So next slide, please. So as was just nicely mentioned, we're talking about respiratory pathogen panels that detect multiple pathogens. There are now several on the market, some of which are FDA cleared, that will detect multiple pathogens within a short period of time, which is very powerful to have a result within an hour or even less to be able to make decisions at a point of care setting. So, for example, the BioFire Film Array respiratory panel detects 22 targets in 45 minutes. And I listed here that there is a CLIA-waived version, which can be done at a point-of-care setting. In fact, we do that in some of our outpatient settings. It's the Respiratory 2.1EZ that detects 19 targets. In addition to the 4 targets in black, which I think usually would fall into probably the 5 targets that this policy, the LCD is covering, there are also all the other targets in red, which are important pathogens in and of their own right. And we know, of course, viruses don't require antibiotic treatment, where some of the bacteria do. And given our global pandemic of antimicrobial resistance testing, it's our belief that detecting of these additional pathogens is quite significant as well. So if you go to the next slide, please. This is the NGS proposed local coverage determination, so I won't go over that again. But if you go to the next slide, I will say that the Mayo Clinic position statement is that panels with more than 5 respiratory pathogens are also acceptable, not just ones with less than or equal to 5 in the Part B outpatient setting when both of those criteria are met. Essentially, that the outpatient setting is equipped to deliver timely results, and with these tests available in 1 hour or even 45 minutes, it could, if designed correctly, really fulfill that requirement. And it has to be done in align with good test stewardship for patients where the test result aids clinical management. If you go to the next slide. So we really look at this from the whole test life cycle. The reimbursement has to be considered in the context of the entire healthcare system. And in our mind, really can't be an all or none black and white decision. There are numerous factors that impact the utility of multiplex respiratory pathogen panels. And the one item I didn't see mentioned in the LCD proposed is judicious patient-based ordering practices. So if we go to the next slide, this is an example of a test ordering algorithm that does include the respiratory pathogens panel that's in the box highlighted in red. This was actually one that we created for coronavirus during, obviously, the ongoing pandemic. It also included influenza and RSV concerns. And we do have the respiratory panel PCR nasal pharynx in there as an option. It's really, though, under the panel or under the option where you have a patient with an influenza-like illness that has risk factors for complicated disease. Now, note that we also have other options if the patient doesn't have these risk factors and isn't undergoing testing for public health or work or travel reasons, we just say testing is not indicated. And many of our algorithms will go down these different aspects where we'll say that testing isn't indicated at all or maybe selective. So if you go to the next slide, the other part of this is delivering the result in a timely manner. And in my mind, if you have a rapid test, but you deliver the results within 1 to 2 days afterwards, then that really isn't providing a meaningful result. This is our turnaround time for the respiratory panel by FilmArray. Our mean turnaround time is 2.5 hours. And you can notice from the different colors on the bottom that we perform this during the day shift, the evening shift, and the midnight shift. We do this as soon as they come in. They are prioritized. There is some variability that's somewhat shift-based. Sometimes we go up to 4 or 5 hours, although that was really during two large peaks of COVID-19 where we were just very hard hit with a lot of different tests at that point. But overall, it actually is pretty steady with our turnaround time between 2 to 3 hours. So next slide, please. So I picked out a couple of examples from the literature that were cited in the proposed LCD, and I wanted to just comment on a couple of them. I actually think that there are several manuscripts in the literature with data that do support the use of a more than 5-pathogen respiratory panel. But if we go to the next slide, I'm just going to comment on two that were actually mentioned in the LCD proposal itself. The first is by Britton Long et al. In 2011. I thought this was a great study, randomized study to control or to determine if multiplex testing would have an impact on antibiotic prescriptions, which really is one of the important points here because we're in this global pandemic of antimicrobial resistance that is becoming widespread and will be very expensive. We need to be able to control that. They looked at that. I think it's interesting. They had their patients randomly assigned to one of two groups, one which they called rapid, but as I highlighted in red, their rapid results were actually in 24 hours, which to me is rather long. The delayed cohort for getting the results from testing was 8 to 12 days. But even with that delayed 24-hour turnaround time, they still found that in that acute setting, when patients first came in with symptom duration of less than or equal to 5 days, that group received fewer antibiotic prescriptions than patients in the delayed result. So they even, and it was statistically significant, even with this, what I would consider to be an unacceptably long delay, they still saw a statistically significant difference. Now, the study goes on to say that at 10 days, when they looked at those two groups, there was no significant difference. To my mind, though, that reflects patient follow-up practices and the physician response to symptomatic patients. Presumably, the patients that were initially not given antibiotics that didn't get better within the next day or two came back, and at that point, the physician, not knowing, wanting to help the patient, gave antibiotics. So to me, that really reflects a need for physician education and follow-up practices, but doesn't reflect the utility of the test itself. So if you go to the next slide, additional supportive data, there was also this other paper in 2018, a randomized non-blinded study, and this study actually did show positive results as well without any caveats. Patients were randomized to receive testing with the respiratory foam array panel within 2 hours versus an IFA in 26 hours, and the patients in the foam array respiratory panel were associated with changes in medical management that was also statistically significant. So the authors had discussed that perhaps it would be hard to take some of these smaller studies and expand them to the larger population, but yet we have several of these studies that do seem to show that medical management is changed with use of a respiratory pathogens panel, more than 5 analytes. So next slide, please. So in summary, there are well-designed studies that have demonstrated a positive impact with multiplex respiratory panels with more than 5 analytes in decreasing unnecessary antibiotic use or changes in patient management. And so we would really argue that reimbursement must be considered in the context of the entire healthcare system, using the available data. I think it's very challenging when you're talking about outpatients to use an all or none approach. These are patients that may be immunocompromised, that may be extremely ill, that may be hospitalized the very next day, that may have severe underlying respiratory disease, and outpatients are such a diverse group. It really needs to have a good ordering algorithm in place to support it. So judicious use for multiplex respiratory panels is an important component of preventing the emergence and spread of antimicrobial resistance. And I'll just say again that this is a significant and costly global issue. We have the power to influence this now with appropriate test utilization. So with that, I will stop, and I would love to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And no, I don't have any questions. I would just want to say that the studies that you did point out, rightfully so, also a big part of their conclusion was the importance of getting the turnaround, which we have reflected in the policy, a quick turnaround and effective system in place to be able to deal with the results. But I do appreciate and thank you for your presentation. Operator, could you please check if there's anybody who would like to make comments about this draft policy?
Absolutely. We would like to open the phone lines for any questions or comments. If you do have a question or comment, please use star 1 on your phone, and one moment to see if we have any. And I am currently showing no questions or comments in queue.
Thank you, operator. Dr. Durden, over to you.
Thank you. So the next policy we're going to be discussing is the epidural procedures that are used for pain management. The first two slides are going to be dealing with the indications. I'll just preface that this policy was assessed and vetted with a multi-jurisdictional CAC on February the 11th, 2021, where we sought a significant amount of input from the multiple societies that represent the physicians that do these epidural injections, as well as the experts that were on the CAC panel. For the policy, we have the start of the first indication for an epidural would be that you can have an epidural injection. It would be considered necessary for the following 3 requirements. And that is that they have to have a history and physical examination with concordant radiologic imaging to show the diagnosis that they're treating. And it has to be supported by the findings of either a lumbar cervical thoracic radiculopathy or and or neurogenic claudication due to that central disc herniation, osteophyte or osteophyte complexes that could occur, severe degenerative disc disease or producing foraminal or central spinal stenosis, or a post-laminectomy syndrome, or acute herpetic associated pain. The and is that they need to have radicular pain that is severe enough to cause a significant degree of functional disability or vocational disability based on an objective scale. And I'm going to touch base with that on the third slide. That functional scale must be performed at baseline if the function is to be considered as part of that assessment. And the epidural would be considered reasonable and necessary if the pain duration is for at least 4 weeks, where there's an inability to tolerate non-invasive conservative management or medical documentation of failure to respond to 4 weeks of non-invasive conservative care or acute herpes zoster is refractory to conservative management where 4 weeks of waiting is not required. So you can go to the next slide. The additional indications for epidurals would be that they must be performed with CT or fluoroscopy image guidance with contrast. They need to be, the transforaminal epidural injections need to involve a maximum of 2 levels at 1 spinal region. It's important to recognize that most conditions would not ordinarily require epidural injections at 2 levels in 1 spinal region. Fourth, the caudal epidural injections and the interlaminar epidural steroid injections involving a maximum of 1 level are considered reasonable and necessary. 5, it is reasonable and necessary to perform transforaminal epidural injections bilaterally when clinically indicated. 6, a repeat epidural steroid injection when the first injection directly and significantly provided improvement of the condition being treated may be considered reasonable and necessary when the medical documents show at least 50% of sustained improvement of pain relief and or improvement of function based on the scale that was used at the beginning or before the epidural injection was given. 7, that epidural injectants must include corticosteroids, anesthetics, anti-inflammatories, and or contrast agents. 8, the epidural steroids should be performed in conjunction with conservative treatments. 9, the patient should be part of an active rehabilitation program, home exercise program, or functional restoration program. Go to the next slide. This slide discusses the scales which can be used, and they are not inclusive, so these are acceptable scales, but not limited to the verbal rating scale, the numeric rating scale, the visual analog scale, the pain disability assessment scale, the Oswestry Disability Index, the Oswestry Low Back Pain Disability Questionnaire, the Quebec Back Pain Disability Scale, the Roland Morris Pain Scale, the Back Pain Functional Scale, or the Patient Reported Outcomes Measurement and Information System Scale. These would be considered reasonable scales or other scales that could be used, but they need to be used at the beginning and after the epidural injection has been performed. Next slide. I'd like to deal with the policy's limitations on epidural injections, and that is epidural injections performed without image guidance or by ultrasound are not considered reasonable and necessary. 2, epidural and steroid injections performed with biologics or other substances not FDA designated for this use are considered not reasonable and necessary. 3, it is not considered reasonable and necessary to perform multiple blocks, such as epidural steroid injections, sympathetic blocks, facet blocks, trigger point injection, during the same session as the epidural steroid injection, with the exception of a facet synovial cyst and an epidural steroid being performed in the same session. 4, the use of general anesthesia, moderate sedation, or monitored anesthetic care is usually unnecessary or rarely indicated for those procedures and therefore not considered medically reasonable and necessary. In exceptional cases, documentation must clearly establish the need for sedation in the specific patient. 5, epidural steroid injections used to treat nonspecific low back pain, axial spine pain, complex regional pain syndrome, widespread diffuse pain, pain from a neuropathy from other causes, cervicogenic headaches are considered investigational and therefore not considered medically reasonable and necessary. And 6, epidural and steroid injections are limited to a maximum of 4 sessions per spinal region in a rolling 12-month period. And if you can go to the next slide, I'll finish up with the limitations. In that, 7, it is not considered medically reasonable and necessary for more than one spinal region to be injected in the same session. 8, it is not considered medically reasonable and necessary to perform transforaminal epidural injections at more than 2 nerve root levels during the same session. It is not considered medically reasonable and necessary to perform caudal epidurals or interlaminar epidural injections at more than 1 level during the same session. It is not considered reasonable and necessary to perform caudal epidural injections or interlaminar epidural injections bilaterally. It is not considered reasonable and necessary to perform epidural injections in a series. And then the next slide, I'll finish up the last few limitations. And that is number 12, steroid dosing should be the lowest effective amount and should not exceed 40 milligrams of methylprednisolone, 10 to 20 milligrams of triamcinolone acetate, or 10 milligrams of dexamethasone phosphate per the session. And 13, and finally, it would generally not be considered reasonable and necessary for treatment with epidural injections to extend beyond 12 months. Frequent continuation of epidural steroid injections over 12 months may trigger a focused medical review. Use beyond the 12 months requires the following. The pain has to be severe enough to cause a significant degree of functional disability or vocational disability. The epidural injection needs to provide at least 50% of sustained improvement of pain and/or 50% objective improvement in function using those scales that were tested at baseline. B, the rationale for the continuation of epidural steroid injections, including but are not limited to, a patient who is a high surgical risk candidate and couldn't have the surgery, or a patient that does not desire surgery, or the patient that has recurrence of pain in the same location relieved with an epidural steroid injection for at least 3 months. And D, communication with the primary care provider regarding the patient's candidacy for prolonged repeat steroid epidural injection use. So having outlined those policy indications and limitations, I understand we have someone who would like to make a presentation, so I'll turn the time over to Dr. Rittenberg.
Hi there. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for having me on to comment on this. So I'm at Kaiser Permanente in California and representing the Spine Intervention Society as well. You can go to the next slide. Okay, I have no disclosures. And we'll go to the next slide. So just a few comments on indications, and these are kind of minor ones. So with history physical exam to support radiculopathy or neurogenic claudication, it should probably be radicular pain rather than radiculopathy. The distinguishing point is radiculopathy is generally accompanied by neurologic deficits. So radicular pain is really the indication that we're treating. So many patients will have severe radicular pain without any physical examination findings of a neurologic deficit. Also commenting on straight leg raise, that is a specific test for radicular pain, but it's not very sensitive, so a lot of times it will not be present. Most importantly, the patients with radicular pain who do not have a positive straight leg raise or neurologic deficit are just as likely to respond to epidurals as those who do have those findings. Next slide. So we would suggest rewording that to be if history and or physical examination and diagnostic imaging supporting one of the following lumbar, cervical, or thoracic radicular pain. And go to the next slide. And then going to covered indications. So the requirement of 4 weeks of pain duration. We do feel that it's unrealistic to expect a patient with acute radicular pain from a disc herniation to delay an epidural steroid injection. These are actually the patients that tend to benefit the most from the procedure. So we suggest rewording as pain duration of at least 4 weeks, with exception made for severe radicular pain where a 4-week delay cannot be tolerated. Next slide. Okay, next on requirement for the use of contrast. Again, we fully support the use of contrast, except in patients who have a documented contrast allergy or who are pregnant. So suggesting the following wording, epidural steroid injections may be performed under CT or fluoroscopic guidance with contrast unless the patient has a documented contrast allergy or is pregnant. And then add to that ultrasound guidance without contrast may be considered in these and similar circumstances. Next slide. Again, the covered indications, repeat injections. So if after an initial injection the patient's pain returns prior to 3 months, it is reasonable to attempt to reinstate relief with a repeat injection. If there's a 3-month threshold required after initial injection, a significant number of patients who would otherwise obtain relief from a second injection may proceed on to surgery. Next slide. So we would suggest the following change in wording. Repeat ESIs are appropriate when 1 to 2 prior epidural steroid injections provided prolonged reduction in radicular pain of at least 50% relief for at least 3 months for the condition being treated. ESIs should not be repeated within 14 days. If a patient fails to respond to a single ESI, a repeat ESI after 14 days can be performed using a different approach and or different medication with the rationale of medical necessity for the second ESI documented in the medical record. Okay, next slide. This is for ESI injectants. So the current wording is somewhat confusing. So what we're saying is if the injections do not include steroid, then they are not epidural steroid injections. So suggest replacing ESI injectant with epidural injectate. So the wording that we would recommend is the epidural injectate must include contrast agent unless the patient has a contraindication to contrast. Injectate may also include corticosteroids, local anesthetic, saline, and or anti-inflammatories. Okay, next slide. Okay, on to covered indications. So the requirement for other conservative treatments, while some patients will certainly benefit from multimodal treatment, there are others who experience relief from an epidural steroid injection and may not require additional conservative treatment. So we suggest rewording to include to indicate that epidural steroids injections may be performed in conjunction with conservative treatments. Okay, next slide. And then the new indication of diagnostic spinal nerve root block, we suggest including the following. Diagnostic spinal nerve blocks are performed by injecting anesthetics onto a single spinal nerve to help confirm or rule out the source of the patient's pain, often to assist in surgical planning. These blocks utilize the same CPT codes as transforaminal epidural steroid injections and should be allowed in patients that may have failed a therapeutic epidural steroid injection when the medical necessity is documented in the medical records. Next slide. Okay, so on to limitations. So I'm just going to – I have one extra slide in my set here. So yeah, I'm going to go off a little differently here. So under number six, the limit of 4 epidural steroid injections per 12 months, we suggest considering allowance of 3 epidurals per 6 months and 6 per 12 months, regardless of the number of levels involved. And then going back to number one, which is injections performed without image guidance or by ultrasound guidance, suggest allowing for ultrasound guidance in patients with documented contraindication to contrast media. And now to number 11, and under series of epidural steroid injections, while we do not support a series of 3, we do support repeat injections if previous injections were successful in achieving pain relief and functional improvement for only one, or only one prior injection was unsuccessful. So we'd suggest rewording as follows. It is not medically reasonable and necessary to prescribe a predetermined series of epidural steroid injections. Okay, next slide. A steroid dose. We feel that the dosages that are recommended are inaccurate. Data from studies looking at dosages implemented in transforaminal injections have been inappropriately extrapolated here to interlaminar injections. So we suggest rewording as follows to allow for slightly higher dosages consistent with the previous version of the LCD. Steroid dosing should be the lowest effective amount, not to exceed 80 milligrams of triamcinolone or 80 milligrams of methylprednisolone, 12 milligrams of betamethasone, or 15 milligrams of dexamethasone per session. On to number 13, treatments exceeding 12 months. We feel that this limitation is unreasonable and the requirements add a significant documentation burden to explain that a patient does not wish to proceed with surgery. We suggest omitting this, requiring the pain physician to communicate with the primary care provider to discuss whether the patient is eligible for prolonged repeat steroid use places undue burden on physicians and should not be required. Next slide. Okay. Provider qualifications. We're recommending considering replacing healthcare professionals with physicians, so physicians have the requisite training to accurately select patients, safely perform technically demanding procedures, and to immediately recognize, evaluate, and address potentially serious life-altering complications. Next slide. Okay, we recommend the following language. Patient safety and quality of care mandate that healthcare professionals who perform epidural injection procedures for chronic pain, not surgical anesthesia, are appropriately trained by an accredited allopathic or osteopathic medical residency or fellowship program in an ABMS or AOA accredited specialty whose core curriculum includes the performance and management of the procedures addressed in this policy. If the practitioner works in a hospital at any time and or is credentialed by a hospital for any procedure, the practitioner must be credentialed to perform the same procedure in the outpatient setting. At a minimum, training must cover and develop an understanding of anatomy and drug pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics, as well as proficiency in diagnosis and management of chronic pain-related disease, the technical performance of the procedure, and utilization of the required associated imaging modalities. Okay, next slide. Sorry, I do have another slide as well. So in terms of society guidance, which is part of this. It should be also be noted that the North American Spine Society revised their coverage policy recommendations in 2020, and these should be reviewed and replace the 2013 and 2011 references that were listed on pages 25 and 26. Also, there were some typos of the following society names. So one, American Society of Anesthesiologists, American Association of Neurological Surgeons and Congress of Neurological Surgeons, and Spine Intervention Society. Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity to make this presentation. Any questions?
We appreciate you. I don't have any questions, but I appreciate your thorough review and significant number of comments, and absolutely we'll take these under advisement.
That's great. Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. Operator, can you check and see if there's any other comments about the draft policy?
Absolutely. Again, that's star one if you have any questions or comments on the phone. One moment to see if we have any questions or comments.
Seeing no additional comments, I'll go ahead and close the comments for this draft policy and turn the time over.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Durden. The next draft that we'll be discussing is the non-invasive fractional flow reserve, FFR, for stable ischemic heart disease. And this is a new draft, but just historically, these procedures were described using T codes, and when the T codes first of all came out, NGS decided to include them in our CCTA policy, and pending more literature to further help us make a policy, which we have now been able to receive. We've now received them, now we're able to separate them out and create their own policy. They also no longer have the T codes and now have the Category 1 code. So the indication in this draft policy states that FDA-approved FFRCT technology may be considered reasonable and necessary in the management of patients with symptomatic stable ischemic heart disease when the CCTA analysis is completed and demonstrates one of the following criteria. Number one, left main disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, lumen diameter reduction of 30 to 50%, or proximal and mid-left anterior descending coronary artery disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, that is lumen reduction 40 to 70%, or proximal and mid-left circumflex disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, that is a lumen reduction of 40 to 70%, considered equivalent to two-vessel disease, or proximal two- or three-vessel disease with intermediate coronary stenosis in at least two vessels, or right coronary disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, that is lumen reduction 40 to 70%. Next slide, please. Questions in this draft LCD. FFRCT is not considered reasonable in the following clinical circumstances. Severe obesity, that is BMI greater than 39 kilograms per meter squared, prior placement of prosthetic valves, known severe aortic stenosis, prior placement of grafts in coronary bypass surgery, suspicion of acute coronary syndrome, that is where MI or unstable angina have not been ruled out, intracoronary metallic stent, status post heart transplantation. Next slide. The limitations continue. Recent MI, that is 30 days or less. Prior pacemaker or defibrillator lead placement. Newly diagnosed systolic heart failure with no prior left heart catheterization. Left main coronary artery disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, that is lumen reduction less than or equal to 30%. Non-obstructing stenosis on CTA, that is less than 50% of all major epicardial vessels, or catheterization in the past 12 months in the absence of a new symptom complex. Next slide, please. This service should be performed in patients with stable coronary symptoms, as the title infers. It should not be performed until after the BAE study, that is CCTA, has been completed and interpreted. If higher grade stenosis are present, that is greater than 70%, this study is not medically necessary, as the patient should proceed to catheterization. Similarly, low-grade stenosis do not require additional confirmatory data. That would be in the case of less than 30% stenosis. If more than two intermediate-risk coronary lesions are identified, the clinical situation is considered high-risk, and the patient should proceed directly to catheterization. In the last slide, while FFRCT shows an exciting potential for reducing the need for an invasive coronary angiogram, the precise role for its use has not yet been entirely determined. The reduced PPV of positive predictive value of FFRCT between 52% to 65%, and the low correlation in the 0.7 to 0.8 lesion range of 46.1% suggests the correlation between FFRCT and invasive FFR in this group is a 10 or 50%. The role of FFRCT and potential benefit in intermediate stenosis between 40 to 70% has been most clearly established. However, there is insufficient outcome data to define management changes based on FFRCT for high grade, that is greater than 70% lesions, that would typically triage to catheterization. There is both limited evidence and a lack of major societal guidance on the use of FFRCT to guide ischemic heart disease revascularization. So we did have requests to present or speak to this draft. And so if Dr. Rogers is on the call, operator, if we could open his line, and I'll hand over to him.
Dr. Rogers, your line is open.
Yes. Yes, are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can, Dr. Rogers. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address this open meeting, and of course, all of our comments will be included in written comments as well. If we could go to the next slide, please. The three areas I'd like to touch on each briefly are, one, an overview of the pathway, just to clarify a couple of aspects. Second, to talk about exclusions as listed in the draft LCD and areas for potential suggested revisions, and then the same for the indications. Go to the next slide, please. The testing pathway is important to emphasize that the pathway, as has been described, begins with coronary CTA, and that in the majority of patients, that is the only test needed, including patients who have very severe disease, as well as patients who have minimal or no disease identified by the CTA. It is in the middle portion, patients with some disease, and we'll talk about the specific severity in a minute, who then pass through the heart flow FFRCT analysis, and whose management is then guided cognizant of that information. Move to the next slide, please. In terms of the proposed exclusions highlighted on this slide are six that we will address specifically for suggested revision in the final LCD. Next slide, please. The first three of these six we will address as a group. These are the severe obesity, BMI over 39, prior prosthetic heart valves, and prior pacemaker and defibrillator leads. Go to the next slide, please. I'd like to emphasize that all of these relate to concerns about CTA image quality and whether or not image quality will be degraded to a degree that the HeartFlow FFRCT analysis cannot be completed. In terms of the process HeartFlow undertakes for providing FFRCT, doing the FFRCT analysis, that process begins very specifically with an assessment of coronary CTA image quality. It's a quantitative assessment. It is part of our FDA clearance, this aspect of our process. Each vessel is reviewed and graded for image quality. Again, there's a quantitative scoring method applied. And for cases which fail to meet the sufficient image quality to process for FFRCT, there is no analysis performed and there are no charges for the service in those cases. Furthermore, we provide an explanation for each failed case as well as training to help improve image quality for future studies. You go to the next slide, please. This shows an example just for people to see visually what we're talking about, moving from excellent to satisfactory to poor image quality, and it's readily apparent even to a novice observer the level of fidelity that one sees in terms of the coronary lumen. The lumen in these pictures appears light. The contrast is light. And one can see, of course, in the poor image quality, it's very hard to discriminate the borders of the arteries. What we see overall is above 90% acceptance rate for real-world users. But again, there are cases which fail quality. Sometimes the failure is related to artifacts from pacemaker leads or prosthetic heart valves, or patients who are whose BMI is so high that it obscures adequate imaging. But there are other patients who have those same conditions in whom the image quality is acceptable, and we do provide the FFRCT analysis. Next slide. If you go to the next slide again, please. So our proposed revisions for these three exclusions is that the image quality, if CTA image quality data is unacceptable, that we provide feedback and there is no processing and no charge. So we suggest that these exclusions be removed from the final LCD. Next slide. The next two I'd like to address are known severe aortic stenosis and suspicion of acute coronary syndrome. The first, known aortic stenosis. Part of the FFRCT analysis process considers what aortic stenosis does to the heart, which is to cause hypertrophy of the left ventricle and increase left ventricular mass. These changes are measured on CTA as part of our process, and we take them into account in doing the FFRCT analysis. There is no reason to suspect different physiology other than that effect of hypertrophy, and therefore the calculations that go into the FFRCT analysis should be consistent and accurate in aortic stenosis, so we suggest removing this. The second, suspicion of acute coronary syndrome, starts to suggestion that this wording be revised to mirror what was revised and incorporated in the final LCDs from Palmetto, Noridian, CGS, and WPS. That language is shown on the slide, and it is that suspicion of acute coronary syndrome where acute MI and unstable angina have not been ruled out is the exclusion. That means that patients who may have suspicion of acute coronary syndrome, but in fact don't have acute coronary syndrome, but have stable chest pain, can be included as covered in the final LCD. Next slide. And then the final draft exclusion we suggest modifying is intracoronary metallic stent. A heart flow is indicated for and labeled for some patients who have intracoronary metallic stents. The list of those is shown below. The list of patients for whom we are not indicated and is not within our IFU, it is a subset of patients who have intracoronary metallic stents, and we would suggest that the final LCD reflect what is in our product labeling. Next slide. In terms of the list of proposed inclusions, we won't review them. They're captured here as they were read by the prior speaker. Next slide, please. And I want to highlight the group of patients and the stenoses which are above the current suggested proposed LCD boundaries of 40 to 70%. That is patients in whom the stenosis is 70 to 90%. there is substantial published outcomes data related to utility and outcomes in this set of patients. If one looks in this table in the box to the right, patients whose stenosis is 70 to 90% have a negative FFRCT analysis. In other words, they may well not need to go to the cath lab if that stenosis is in the LAD at 17% of patients. If it's in the left circumflex, nearly 40% of such patients will have a negative FFRCT and potentially avoid a trip to the cath lab, even though their stenosis is 70 to 90%. And for the RCA, it's nearly a third of patients. So the utility in this group of patients is significant, and a significant proportion may be able to be managed conservatively, avoiding the risk and expense of invasive angiography, even though they have a stenosis over 70%. Next slide. In terms of data from our studies, and the reference, I apologize, is on this slide, the formatting has made it hard to see. It's from our advanced registry, which suggests, and this is for the utility in these patients, that 62% of patients in a 5,000-patient prospective registry with clinical follow-up published out to 1 year, that 62% of these patients had a different management plan after the physicians were provided with the FFRCT than they would have after the CTA alone. So the notion is the data are strong, and it's quite clear to current users that patients who have a 70 to 90% stenosis have a substantial amount to gain from having access to FFRCT when their physician thinks it may be of help in their management. Next slide. So in terms of proposed revision to the list of inclusions, it is our suggestion that the left main number one remain just as it is, but that the others be revised to coronary artery disease with coronary stenosis of uncertain functional significance and a lumen reduction of 40 to 90% rather than 40 to 70%. Next slide. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and certainly would be happy to address any questions which people may have at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Thank you very much for presenting these findings, and I don't have any follow-up questions, but as you had said, thank you for also mentioning that you will be sending them in writing, which I do appreciate you bringing that up because I haven't really mentioned it to the other people who have presented today. So if they could please send the presentations and all comments to us in writing, we would appreciate that. So is Dr. Marshall on the call, operator? If he is, if you could please open up his line. I believe he has comments.
Dr. Marshall, your line
Hello?
Is open.
Hi. Well, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name's Jeff Marshall, and I guess first, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Dr. Marshall. Please proceed.
Okay. So like I said, I'm a board-certified interventional cardiologist, and I have no conflicts of interest and am not receiving any financial support for this. I'm here today actually representing the Society for Cardiovascular Angiography and Interventions, abbreviated SCAI. And SCAI is the largest not-for-profit professional association of interventional cardiologists with almost 5,000 members. SCAI promotes excellence in interventional cardiovascular medicine through education, representation, and advancement of quality standards to enhance patient care. SCAI believes that there's strong scientific evidence for performance of FFRCT as a non-invasive diagnostic test in patients with stable ischemic heart disease and intermediate coronary artery disease by CTA. SCAI is specifically pleased that the proposal of the local coverage decision does not place restrictions on coverage of invasive FFR, which is a complementary procedure to FFRCT. Invasive FFR is performed at the time of a coronary angiogram to evaluate specific lesions or blockages within the coronary arteries, And generally speaking, interventional cardiologists, while they're actually performing an angiogram, use invasive FFR as a physiologic test to determine whether or not to perform or defer percutaneous interventions, that is, to do angioplasty or place a stent. Indeed, in some situations, the performance of invasive FFR at the time of an angiogram results in the avoidance of unnecessary coronary interventions, and that reduces cost. There are, however, significant differences in the accuracies of invasive FFR and FFR-CT. And like I stated before, several studies have shown that in some cases, FFR-CT positive lesions end up having negative invasive FFR procedures and interventions are deferred or avoided. FFR is a very sensitive test, and interventional cardiologists use it. But by default, there are a number of false positives that can be either confirmed or refuted with invasive FFR if the patient indeed goes on to angiography. Invasive FFR does remain the gold standard for assessing complex coronary disease and invasive angiography. And I think it's still the best way to to accurately assess serial coronary lesions. And invasive FFR is accompanied, like FFR-CT, by lots of outcomes data from large numbers of clinically randomized trials. So as an interventional cardiologist, I'm not here to review the details or restrictions of the coverage for FFR-CT that are contained in your current proposal. We actually defer to the experts that have spoken or will speak on those matters. So in summary, SCAI supports NGS's proposal to codify coverage for FFR-CT and are pleased the proposal does not restrict subsequent coverage of invasive FFR procedures. In the future, if NGS identifies individuals that are routinely, that is on every case, doing both FFR-CT and invasive FFR, we believe that that should be investigated. FFR-CT is complementary to invasive FFR physiology and not a substitute. And I'd like to thank Drs. Sigaroa and Tukaye who put this together. And as a professional society, we'd like to offer to the National Government Services that as it continues to review this proposed LCD, please don't hesitate to contact Mr. Wayne Powell, part of our advocacy group, and his phone number is 703-772-7910. And his email address is wpowell, P-O-W-E-L-L, @scai.org. Thank you very much for having me today.
Thank you, Dr. Marshall. Again, if you could please put those comments in writing and send them to us, we would appreciate that. Operator, could you please check? Thank you very much, Dr. Marshall. Operator, could you please check if anybody on the line, anyone else on the line has comments?
Dr. Dolodelli, Dr. Bourne, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I have a question for Dr. Marshall and a statement for Dr. Rogers. For Dr. Marshall, what percentage of people of time you think they should be getting, people getting the FFR with their coronary computed tomography? I mean, is it something you expect? Oh, you know, 5%, 100%, any ballpark figure.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I don't have specifically a ballpark figure. I think that these are instantaneous decisions made by an interventionalist when they see the anatomy. We use FFR-CT a lot, and we can see the anatomy there, but I have to say that as interventional doctors, we're much more used to interpreting angiograms. And when we see intermediate lesions, we want to then confirm or refute that. to avoid putting in unnecessary stents. So I can't personally give you an absolute number. I think that the number is low only because my personal experience with my non-invasive partner sending FFRCT to me, that it seems to be quite accurate. It is a very sensitive test, so the number of false positives are real, and that's what we can confirm or refute in the cath lab. Sorry, I don't have a specific number.
And so you, okay, so you, at the in the cath lab, how often, you percentage-wise, can you have any guess how, what percentage in the cath lab get this?
Well, it that varies from cath lab to cath lab. And this is just how physicians are trained and what they understand about the difference between anatomy and physiology. In some laboratories, invasive FFR is used in almost every intermediate lesion. In some cath labs, anatomy is used more often. But the national use of invasive FFR is creeping up. I don't know the most recent numbers, but I would say that it's less than 10 or 15% of all patients that undergo coronary angiography that receive invasive FFR. But that number has been creeping up over the last 5 to 10 years.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And for Dr. Rogers, one point we need to make is that you know, you state that your company, if it's a poorly qualified, poor quality study, you don't charge for it, and therefore we don't have to worry about a number of these exclusions. But you must understand that this policy is not specific to any proprietary product. And while your company obviously is very has a lot of integrity, it's quite possible that other companies might not be as magnanimous as your company, and they might continue to bill for poor quality services. So again, this is not a product-specific LCD. It is a, I hate to say generic, but that's probably the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Boren. So, operator, could you please ask people on the line if they have any additional comments concerning
this
policy?
Yes, absolutely. If you do have any questions or comments, please use star 1. It looks like we do have Stefan Zeb from WBU Institute. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Irfan Zeb. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Please proceed. Thank you.
So I'm a non-invasive cardiologist from West Virginia, and I'm also a member of a Society of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography that deals with coronary CT angiography. So I agree with the comments made by Dr. Campbell, and I don't have any comments to add this time. However, we will also submit our comments in writing to the NGS. Thank you. From the society.
Thank you very much, Dr. Operator, could you check if there's anyone else?
I am currently showing no one else in queue.
Okay, thank you very much. So I will proceed to the last draft, on the agenda for today, and it is actually concerning the cardiac computed tomography, that's the CCT, and coronary computed tomography angiography, the CCTA policies that we currently have, and it's a revision to those policies. And basically, in light of what we, the draft that we just discussed, the following indication has been deleted. Letter J, FFRCT. This test may be considered medically necessary when CCTA shows CAD of uncertain functional significance or is non-diagnostic, and where the addition of functional information provided by FFRCT can help the physician determine which patient may require invasive evaluation and or treatment. and obviously it also saves. Please refer to the new non-invasive fractional flow reserves, that's FFR, for stable ischemic heart disease, which is currently in draft. So we do need to take these two policies through the same procedure so that when the other one finalizes, this one can also be revised to show that, so that there's no confusion in direction. So I will hand over to, I think I can let everybody know who's on the call that the official comment period, if you can go to the next slide, please. Official comment period ends on July 17, 2021. We'd like to thank everybody who presented today and who had comments, and also just remind everyone to please send their comments in writing. So anybody who wants to comment on a proposed LCD that we discussed today during the official comment period, that is prior to July 17, 2021, should please send their comments to Part B LCB comments at anthem.com, and if by snail mail to National Government Services, Inc., LCB comments, P.O. Box 7108, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46207, 7108. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a
Dr. O'Dowd?
Yes, Dr. Haug. Yes.
Yeah, just to emphasize also, if they send in those comments, to include the conflict of interest disclosure, that's very important.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Please do include your conflict of interest. I believe we're done for today. Operator, you may disconnect the call.
Thank you all for participating in today's conference. You may disconnect your line and enjoy the rest of your day.